From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland. I'm from East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from the Sunset.
A foggy inner sunset.
I live in the Mish.
2015 marks the Grateful Dead's 50th anniversary, and on today's show, we're embracing our inner deadhead. First, we'll tap into the Library of Congress archives to hear Jerry Garcia talk about the origin of the group.
Our booking agent was this guy who used to book strippers and dog acts and magicians and everybody else. You know?
Then we hear from one of the band's former managers on working alongside the bearded frontman.
He was one of these kind of people that were a leaderless leader, kind of like a rock and roll Buddha to me in a way.
A rock and roll history lesson that only the Bay Area could provide. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. The Grateful Dead. It's been 50 years since the original band members began playing together in clubs around Palo Alto and San Francisco. In that time, they've sold 35 million records. But more importantly, they inspired an unprecedented culture of fandom. Bill Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Tony Blair, and hundreds of thousands of dedicated fans who flock to Grateful Dead performances throughout the country. This weekend, hundreds of thousands of those deadheads are expected to fill Chicago's Soldier Field as the band plays what they say are their final three concerts ever. Four original band members are set to play the concert, but the Dead's beloved frontman will be missing. Jerry Garcia passed away in 1995. The judge decreed it. In 1967, the Grateful Dead signed with record executive Joe Smith and released their debut album on the Warner Brothers label. During the mid-1980s, Smith interviewed dozens of legendary rock musicians that he previously worked with, including Jerry Garcia. Now, let's hear an excerpt from that 1985 interview in which we hear what it was like to be in the band during its first few years.
So when the band finally fell into place as the Warlocks, it was basically what was the Grateful Dead.
Absolutely. Kreutzmann, me,
yeah.
Phil.
Pig and Bobby, yeah.
That's right.
And what did it sound like?
It sounded like hell. It sounded really awful for the first few gigs.
Was it the Warlocks very long before you became the Dead?
About a year.
And what triggered the new identity?
Well, we finally discovered that there was a band that was recording under using the name Warlocks. And we said, oh, we can't have that kind of confusion. So we went on the band hunt, you know, looking
right.
for a name.
The name came from whom? Who dug it up?
Well, I found it in an old dictionary at Phil's house. And I just opened it up, and there I saw the Grateful Dead.
Jesus, you could have been, could you imagine what would have happened? The Warlock Heads, I mean, the dictionary changed society.
Yes, it did, yes, it did. That was about the time we fell in with the acid test and Keezy and those guys. We had started taking acid ourselves while we were still the Warlocks. We didn't do it at shows. At the time we were playing the Divorcees bars up and down the peninsula, you know?
Yeah.
Our booking agent was this guy who used to book strippers and dog acts and magicians and everybody else, you know. And it was the standard gig, six nights a week, five sets a night, standard bar stuff. We were doing that for about a year. And, you know, after that, you're ready for anything. We knew a lot of the people in Keezy's scene because it was all part of the Palo Alto scene, which we were part of. And they knew of us. The one guy named Paige, who was one of the pranksters, came to one of our late-night sets at one of the bars we were playing at. I said, hey, you guys, we're having these parties up at Keezy's place in La Honda every Saturday night. Why don't you guys come? And we said, well, we're working all the time. Luckily, the following week, we got fired, and we had nothing to do. So Saturday night came around. We went to the first one of those parties, which later became the acid test.
And what did you do there? I mean, it was just experimenting?
No, we set up the equipment, you know. Everybody got high. and stuff would happen. Now, Kesey and his pranksters have been doing this for a long time. They had instruments, they played weird music, but mostly it was completely free. There was no real performance of any kind involved. Everybody there was as much performer as audience, you know. These guys had never been confronted with a regular rock and roll band, you know. And we plugged our gear in, which looked like space-age military nightmare stuff compared to all their stuff, which was hand-painted and real funky, you know. And we played about 5 minutes, you know, and then we all freaked out, you know. We played for about 5 minutes, but it completely devastated everyone, you know. So they begged us to come back to the next one. And that's how it happened, essentially.
When you guys now, you're doing some acid, you're playing around, what did you expect to be? Were you going to be a Beatles? Were you going to be a great rock and roll? What were you going
to
do?
We didn't really care whether we went somewhere specifically. We mostly wanted to have fun. And when we fell in love with the acid test, we started having the most fun we'd ever had, ever. You know, more than we could have ever... I mean, it was just incredible.
And how long did that go on?
For about 6 months. But that was probably the most important 6 months in terms of directionality. Because the neat thing about the acid test was we could play if we wanted to, but if it was too weird, we could always not play. You know, so that was the only time we ever had the option of not playing.
I lit up from Reno, I was trailed by 20 hounds. Didn't get to sleep that night till the morning came around. Sit out, run, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
That was the late Jerry Garcia, interviewed by the retired record executive Joe Smith. Thanks to David Gerlach, who produced that interview for the PBS series Blank on Blank. If you want to hear more historical interviews from Joe Smith and many others, you can subscribe to the Blank on Blank podcast at blankonblank.org. We'll include a link at kalw.org.
I ran down to the levee, but the devil caught me there. He took my $20 bill and it vanished in the air. I'm running, but take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. In addition to the ultra-sold-out shows this weekend in Chicago, many other celebrations are being planned for the Grateful Dead's 50th anniversary year. In August, the Jerry Garcia Amphitheater in San Francisco's McLaren Park, not far from us here at KALW, will be hosting its annual Jerry Day with performances of iconic Grateful Dead songs. Filmmaker Martin Scorsese is working on a feature documentary spanning the band's entire career. And in Berkeley, an adult education program created a one-time class where older rockers not only relive the past, but learn about what made the Grateful Dead such a cultural force. KALW's Jeremy Dalmas stopped by to meet those devoted Grateful Dead students and their leader.
That's like a good introduction song to have right at the beginning of a radio piece on the Grateful Dead.
Teacher Peter Richardson mulls the question over for a moment.
One song that Jerry Garcia loved, but it wasn't their song, is a song called I Know You Rider. Garcia had an especially favorite verse. I wish I was a headlight on a northbound train.
I wish I was on a northbound train.
It doesn't get played that often, but I think it really captures something. The romance of the open road and a sense of adventure. And they modeled that wanderlust for maybe two generations of fans.
I think I listened to the Grateful Dead maybe once before I started this piece, but this seemed like a unique chance to see what all the fuss was about. Peter Richardson, a lecturer at San Francisco State, was teaching a course on the Grateful Dead at a school for adults over 50. A cultural history class where the students were likely part of both the culture and the history? Fascinating, right? But would I leave the class a deadhead?
I think we're ready to start. Welcome back.
He's addressing about 60 students. Appropriately enough, the lecture hall is Freight and Salvage, a folk music venue in Berkeley that started in the 1960s. During the lecture, he brings up a recent concert by a band named Further that had two former Dead members.
I did see their show at the Greek Theater last fall. Anybody go to that? Yeah. I went to the Sunday afternoon show.
On a break, I walk up to a student. If you were to recommend a song?
I guess A Touch of Grey.
Susan Sperber looks the baby boomer part.
Look, I have a tie-dye shirt on and sandalwood beads.
And she told me that recapturing the 1960s is exactly why she is here. This class on the Dead is part of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, OLLI for short. They offer liberal arts classes for older adults, and Sperber has taken a lot of classes here.
When I retired, I needed to do something to keep active. It's very, very easy to get old. It's not that you don't want to get older, but just you can get old. And OLLI helps us to keep our minds going.
Her song, Touch of Grey, was their biggest hit, in 1987, no less. Every silver lining's got a touch of grey. Unlike other OLLI classes, people here are steeped in the culture that the class is covering. In 1970, the Dead were arrested for drug possession in New Orleans. When it came up in lecture, Richardson says a hand shot up.
And one of the students said, I was in New Orleans in 1970. I went to that show, and I remember when that arrest was made.
Imagine taking a class on the French Revolution, and some of the students had stormed the Bastille. But there are plenty of students who started listening to the band in the 1980s and 90s. Turns out that was the height of their popularity, not the 1960s. Fritzi Schoen is a student who got introduced to the band by her children. She and her husband are in their 80s.
We're season ticket holders of opera for the last 40 years, and we go to Baroque music. We love music.
So when they told their children they were going to take the class?
Our kids said, oh my God, they're nuts. You're old. And we are old, you know, 80 and 89. We're old. And we love the music, and especially the harmony.
Like in Baroque music, the Dead's harmonies are good. She points to the song, Sugar Magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty and I don't care. Swimming baby down by the river, knew she'd have to come up super air. Richardson says the Dead's fan base is much more diverse than how it's usually portrayed.
There's been 3 U.S. senators, athletes like Bill Walton, there's been scholars like Joseph Campbell, and that if you're really trying to understand the Dead's audience, you have to include those people too, and not just the stereotypical Deadhead kind of selling a dream catcher or a veggie burrito out in the parking lot.
As someone who doesn't know anything about the Dead, how would you sell the class to me?
Well, I would say there were a lot of 60s symbols that didn't even make it into the 70s. The Grateful Dead made it into the 90s. You know, it's an extraordinary story. These middle-aged rockers were peaking in 1991, 20 years after Woodstock.
That makes the connection between these fans and the band a little clearer. They aged together. I talked with one last student in the class, Christine Caldwell. The song she recommends, Dark Star, the Dead's opus that could run 30 minutes long in concert.
You feel it. You actually feel the notes. You feel the energy from the band.
She took the class because she wants to reconnect with how she felt at the concerts. When I asked her what drew her there, she got so excited that she hit my microphone.
It was everything. It was the audience. It was reliving the 60s feeling, you know, the clothing, the tie-dye and everything. I felt so 100%. There is no other place on this planet that I want to be right now. I'm sorry, I don't want to cry.
It's, you know,
it's just
powerful.
Very, very emotional. Yeah.
I got a bit jealous of her. I never get that excited about music anymore. She left me with one last piece of advice.
You should listen to them.
It is a good jam, and the guitars sound great. But I think I agree with what Richardson said about the band. You don't have to like their music to appreciate their story. The Grateful Dead may not be my tribe, but I'm happy I got to join their trip for an afternoon. In Berkeley, I'm Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba.
As I was walking down Rubber Square.
Attending a Grateful Dead concert during the 70s was a powerful and positive experience for many fans. But what was it like for those who worked with the band backstage? Richard Loren was Jerry Garcia's friend and personal manager, and in the 70s, he became agent and manager for the Grateful Dead. Early on, he discovered that working for the Grateful Dead meant also working within its entire collective community, the sometimes upwards of 50 people who were more connected to the band than they were to their own families. Last year, Loren co-authored the book High Notes, a rock memoir, working with rock legends Jefferson Airplane through the Doors to the Grateful Dead. He recently came by our studios, and I asked him about the first time he met Jerry Garcia.
I met Jerry Garcia through a mutual friend of ours named David Grisman. He's a mandolin player. He lives in Marin County, and he and Jerry made, in the 90s, they got together again and had the Garcia Grisman band, and they made albums, five albums together, and of course the end of Jerry's career. But when I was an agent in New York, I always wanted to sign the Grateful Dead, but they didn't want to deal with the business world outside of their scene. They did everything themselves. So I never was able to sign them. But when I met David, David was a friend of Jerry's. They had met in 1964 as bluegrass musicians in a parking lot in West Virginia playing bluegrass music. And so they, in 1969, when I was 70, when I came back from my hiatus from the music business that I spent in Europe for a year, I came back and I ran into David on the street. The Grateful Dead were coming into town to play the Fillmore East. And David said, God, I haven't seen Jerry in 5 years. Let me call him up. Maybe we'll go to the show. So sure enough, he calls Jerry. Jerry says, I'll have backstage passes for you. So we go backstage, 4 o'clock in the morning, after the New Riders and acoustic and electric set with the Grateful Dead, and it's like 4 o'clock. And we go backstage, and there's Jerry, you know, wide-eyed and still ready to talk. And, you know, he pulls out a couple of joints. We're smoking dope. David's there. He said, hey, Jerry, I want you to meet my friend Richard Loren. He used to book the Liberace. Jerry said, I got a few laughs out of that. And, you know, then we got on in the next hour. We were just hanging out and talking.
What was your initial impression of him when you met
him? I loved him. He was one of these kind of people that were a leaderless leader. You know, he led by his example. And I watched the way he treated people and how people respected him. And I thought, well, this is not only just a rock star. This is the way people should behave, you know. So I took a lesson from him. I mean, he was kind of like a rock and roll Buddha to me in a way, you know. So I had a charmed relationship with Jerry for 10 years.
And you took him on.
I had been friends with Jerry for about a year or so by that time, and I just went up to his house one morning, like I did often, and he said, "Richard, you don't really seem too cheerful this morning." Words to that effect. And I don't know, you know, kind of out of work again. And he says, you know, I got a lot of things going on in my life outside the Grateful Dead. You know, I work with the New Riders. I'm playing pedal steel on, you know, a lot of groups in here. I'm overwhelmed with what to do and I can't keep track. I just need some help. Would you be willing to, you know, take care of my personal affairs outside of the Grateful Dead? And in a nanosecond, of course, you know, I'd love to. I'd love to do nothing more than do that. And that's where our career began. And, it was not even on a handshake. It was like, yeah, we just made an agreement. I'd work for you. And that was it. You know, I just worked with him and stayed with him for 10 years. It was very difficult for me on a lot of levels to deal with a lot of the personalities in the group. not necessarily in the band, but in the Grateful Dead community. Because the Grateful Dead community was, the Grateful Dead were all accepting. You know, they very rarely fired anybody. Anybody could do more or less whatever they wanted to. They paid people extraordinarily well. And, you know, working within that community, you know, in the old days, just, you know, I was an agent, you sit behind a desk, you have a secretary, you book a deal, it's accepted, it's not enough money, you get more, you know, you want to change promoters, you go, and done. Within the Grateful Dead, you had to work within the collective. You know, it wasn't just the band members you had to get along with and do, you had to get along with everybody in the scene.
Can you tell me about some of just some of the highlights in that time for you?
The big event that I was involved with, to me, was taking the Grateful Dead to Egypt. To me, that was probably one of the most important events in the chronicles of the Grateful Dead history. They've done a lot of great things, but that one was quite an event. And it happened, in a way, I guess by accident. I went to Egypt, and I, you know, to cut to the chase, I got on a camel one day, and I was riding around the pyramids, and I turned down, and I looked to my left, and I saw a stage. And I said to myself, the Grateful Dead could play here, maybe. Ah. And then that thought never left me. Mm. And the rest of that day, I kept thinking about it, because that stage, I saw the backdrop, the Sphinx. I said, God, if there's any place the Grateful Dead should play, it would be this. So I went back and I told Jerry and the rest of the band, I said, hey, I think we can play in Egypt. He said, oh man, let's go for it. Fantastic. So we donned suits, cut our hair, flew to Washington, met with the State Department, and then went to Egypt, met with the American ambassador to Egypt.
Wore suits.
You know, and then we were given the acronym, the Men in Dark Suits, the MIDS. The Men in Dark Suits, because we had to wear dark suits. So, so we went and, you know, to cut to the chase, basically, after four trips, we got a signed contract to play 3 days at the Pyramid site on September 14th, 15th, and 16th. In the front row, you had these dignitaries all dressed in their suits. And then in front of them were dancing deadheads that flown in from Europe in a chartered plane from San Francisco, you know. And unbelievably, and unbeknownst to us, the last show was a full moon and lunar eclipse, you know. And the night, that night, at the end of the last show, we went on stage, and the news was that they had just signed the Camp David Agreement, you know, which is probably the closest we've ever come to peace in the Middle East, ever. And so that was just another thing that just kind of happened then, you know. I sat down, and when that first note was struck, and the lights came on the Grateful Dead, and the pyramids were there, and the Sphinx were there, I mean, I was just totally, I couldn't contain myself with the joy.
That was Richard Loren, former personal manager to the late Jerry Garcia, as well as agent and manager for the Grateful Dead. You can find more about his book, High Notes, A Rock Memoir, at KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. About the Grateful Dead today. Now we'd love to hear from you. Email us your feedback on today's show at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Allison Lee, Timothy Lou Lee, Holly McDeed, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Rafi Ronquillo, Raja Shah, Lizak Shalit, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Operator, can you help me? Help me if you please. Give me the right area code and the number that I need.
My rider left up on the midnight flyer, singing like a summer breeze. I think she's somewhere down south, down about Baton Rouge. But I just can't remember no number, a number I can use. Directory don't have it, Central done forgot it. Got to find a number to use. Trying to check out a number, trying to run down a line. Operator said that's privileged information and it ain't no business of mine. It's flooding down in Texas, the polls are out in you.